Hello, this is Victor Lopez. I would like to read two poems from my most recent collection of poems, Echoes of Dusk at Dawn, Collected Poems, Volume 2, copyright 2011. Whenever I feel a little bit down, a little bit lonely, and I miss people that I love, I like to read what I have written about them in the past, and this particular reading will involve poems that I wrote immediately after the death of my mom and my dad, and they are part of my longest poem to date, my longest free verse poem, Unsung Heroes. This is Unsung Heroes 5 and Unsung Heroes 6, starting with Unsung Heroes 5 for my dad. Felipe, 1931 to 2016, Dad. You were born 5 years before the Spanish Civil War that would see your father exiled. Language came late to you, later than your little brother Manuel, and you stuttered for a time. Unlike those who speak incessantly with nothing to say, you were quiet and reserved. Your mother mistook shyness for dimness, a tragic mistake that scarred you for life. When your brother Manuel died at the age of 3 from meningitis, you heard your mom exclaim, "God took my bright boy and left me the dull one." You were 4 or 5. You never forgot those words. How could you? Yet you loved your mom with all your heart, but you also withdrew further into a shell of solitude, your only and best friend. You were, in fact, an exceptional child. Stuttering went away at 5 or so, never to return, and by the time you were in middle school, your teacher called your mom in for a rare conference, but told her yours was a gifted mind, and that you should be prepared for university study in the sciences, particularly in engineering. She wrote your father, exiled in Argentina, to tell him the good news, that your teachers believed you would easily win a spot in the highly selective public university, where seats were few, prized, and very difficult to attain based on merit-based competitive exams. Your father's response? Buy him a couple of oxen and let him plow the fields. That reply from a highly respected man who was a big fish in a tiny pond in his native Oleiros is beyond comprehension. He had apparently opted to preserve his own self-interest in having his son continue his business and also work the family lands in his absence. That scar, too, was added to those that would never heal in your pure, huge heart. Left without support for living expenses for college, all it would have required, you moved on, disappointed, but not angry or bitter. You would simply find another way. You took the competitive exams for the 2 local military training schools that would provide an excellent vocational education and pay you a small salary in exchange for military service. Of hundreds of applicants for the few seats in each of these 2 institutions, you ironically scored 1st for the toughest of the 2 and 13th for the 2nd toughest. You had your pick. You chose Fábrica de Armas, the lesser of the 2, so that a classmate who applied only to the better school and just failed to qualify could be admitted. That was you. Always noble. At the military school, you were finally in your element. You were to become a world-class machinist there, a profession that would get you well-paying work anywhere on Earth for as long as you wanted it. And you were truly a mechanical genius who years later would add electronics, auto mechanics, and specialized welding to his toolkit through formal training. Given a well-stocked machine shop, you could reverse engineer every machine sans blueprints and build duplicate machine shops. You became a gifted master mechanic and worked in line and supervisory positions at a handful of companies throughout your life in Argentina and the U.S., including Westinghouse, Warner Lambert, and Pepsi Cola Bottling Company. You loved learning, especially in your fields, electronics, mechanics, and welding, and expected perfection in everything you did. Every difficult job at work was given to you, everywhere you worked. You would not sleep at night when a problem needed solving. You would sketch, calculate, and resketch solutions, and worked even in your dreams with singular passion. You were more than a match for the academic and physical rigors of military school. But life was difficult for you in the Franco era, when some instructors would deprecatingly refer to you as Rojo, Galician for red, reflecting your father's support for the failed republic. Eventually, the abuse was too much for you to bear. Once, while standing at attention in a corridor with other cadets waiting for roll call, you were repeatedly poked in the back surreptitiously. Moving would cause demerits, and demerits could cause loss of points on your final grade and arrest for successive weekends. You took it a while, then lost your temper. You turned to the cadet behind you and in a fluid motion grabbed him by his button jacket and one-handedly hung him up on a hook above a window where you were standing in line. He thrashed about, hanging by the back of his jacket, until he was brought down by irate military instructors. You got weekend arrest for months and a 10% grade reduction. A similar fate befell a co-worker a few years later in Buenos Aires, who called you a son of a whore. You lifted him one-handed by his throat and held him there until your co-workers intervened, forcibly persuading you to put him down. That lesson was learned by all in no uncertain terms. Leave Felipe's mom alone. You were incredibly strong, especially in your youth, no doubt in part because of rigorous farm work, military school training, and competitive sports. As a teenager, you once unwisely bent down to pick something up in full view of a ram, presenting the animal an irresistible target. It butted you and sent you flying into a haystack. It too quickly learned. You dusted yourself off, charged the ram, grabbed it by the horns, and twirled it around the air, throwing it atop the same haystack. The animal was unhurt, but learned to give you a wide berth from that day forward. Overall, you were very slow to anger, absent headbutting, repeated poking, or disrespectful references to your mom throughout your life. I seldom saw you angry, and it was mom, not you, who was the disciplinarian, slipper in hand. There were few slaps from you for me. Mom would smack my behind very often. When I was little, mostly because I could be a real pain, wanting to know, try, do everything, completely oblivious to the meaning of the word no, or of my own limitations. Mom would sometimes insist you give me a proper beating. On one such occasion, when I was a little older, for some forgotten transgression, you took me to your bedroom, took off your belt, sat next to me, and whipped your own arm and hand several times, whispering to me, "Cry," which I was happy to to do unbidden. "Don't tell Mom." I did not. No doubt, Junior. This prospect of serving in a military that considered you a traitor by blood became unbearable, and in the third year of school, 1 year prior to graduation, you left to join your exiled father in Argentina to start a new life. You left behind a beloved mother and two sisters to try your fortune in a new land. Your dog then refused food, dying of grief. You arrived in Buenos Aires to see a father you had not seen for some 15 years at the age of 17. You were too young to work legally, but looked older than your years, a shared trait. So you lied about your age and immediately found work at a machinist mechanic first class that was unheard of and brought jealousy and complaints in the union shop. The union confronted the general manager about your top salary and rank. He answered, "I'll give the same rank and salary to anyone in the company who can do what Felipe can do." The jealousy and grumblings continued for a time, but there were no takers, and you soon won the group over, becoming their protected baby brother mascot. Your dad left for Spain a year or so from your arrival when Franco issued a general pardon to all dissidents who had not spilled blood, who were non-combatants. He wanted you to return to help him reclaim his family business, taken over by you and your mom in his absence. But you refused to give up the high salary, respect, and independence denied you at home. You were 18 or so, alone, living in a single room by a schoolhouse you had shared with your dad, but you also found a new loving family in your uncle Jose, one of your dad's brothers. Jose and one of his daughters, Nieves, her husband, Emilio, and their children, Susana, Oscar, Ruben Gordé, and Osvaldo, became your new family. You married Mom in 1955 and had two failed business ventures in the quickly fading post-World War II Argentina of the late 1950s and early 1960s. The first, a machine shop, left you with a small fortune and unpaid government contract work. The second, a grocery store, also failed due to hyperinflation and credit extended too easily to needy customers. Throughout this, you continued earning an exceptionally good salary, but in the mid-1960s, nearly all of it went to pay back creditors of the failed grocery store. We had some really hard times. Someday, I may write about those days. Mom went to work as a maid, including for wealthy friends, and you left home at 4 a.m. and returned late at night. The only luxury you and Mom retained was my Catholic school tuition. There was no other extravagance. Not paying bills was never an option for you or Mom. It never entered your minds. It was not a matter of law or pride, but a matter of honor. There were at least three very lean years when you and Mom worked hard, earned well, but we were truly poor. You and Mom took great pains to hide this from me and suffered great privations to insulate me from the fallout of a shattered economy, and your refusal to cut your losses had done to your life savings and our once comfortable middle-class life. We came to the United States in the late 1960s after waiting for more than 3 years for visas to a new land of hope. Your sister and brother-in-law, Marisa and Manuel, made their own sacrifices to help bring us here. You had about $1,000 from the down payment on our tiny downsized house, and Mom's pawned jewelry. Hyperinflation and expenses ate up the remaining payments due on the mortgage to you. Other prized possessions were left in a trunk until you could reclaim them. You never did. Even the airline tickets were paid for by Marisa and Manuel. You insisted upon arriving on written terms for repayment, including interest. You were hired on the spot on your first interview as a mechanic, first grade, despite not speaking a word of English. 2 months later, the debt was repaid, Mom was working too, and we moved into our own first apartment here. You worked long hours, including Saturdays and daily overtime, to remake a nest egg. Declining health forced you to retire at 63, and shortly thereafter, you and Mom moved out of Queens, buying a townhouse 2 hours from my apartment residence upstate New York, and for the next decade were happy, traveling with friends and visiting us often. Then things started to change. Heart issues, 2 pacemakers, colon cancer, melanoma, liver and kidney disease caused by your many medications, high blood pressure, gout, gallbladder surgery, diabetes, and still you moved forward. Like the Energizer Bunny, patched up, battered, scarred, bruised, but completely unstoppable and unflappable. Then Mom started to show signs of memory loss along with other health issues. She was good at hiding her own ailments, and we noticed much too late than we should have, that there was something seriously wrong. 2 years ago, her dementia worsening, but still functional. Gallbladder surgery with complications required 4 separate surgeries in 3 months. She never recovered and had to be placed in a nursing home. Several, in fact, as at first she refused food and you and I refused to simply let her waste away, which would have been kinder, but for the fact that mientras hay vida, hay esperanza, as Spaniards say, while there is life, there is hope. There is nothing beyond the power of God. Miracles do happen. For 2 years, you lived alone, refusing outside help, engendering numerous arguments about having someone go by several times a week to help clean, cook, and do chores. You are nothing if not stubborn, yet another shared trait. The last argument on the subject 2 weeks ago ended in your crying. You'd accept no outside help until Mom returned home. You were in great pain because of bulging discs in your spine, and you walked with one of those rolling seats with handlebars that Mom and I picked out for you some years ago. You'd sit as needed when the pain was too much, and get up and continue with a little by way of complaint. 10 days ago, you finally agreed that you needed to get to the hospital to drain abdominal fluid. Your failing liver produced it and swelled your abdomen and lower extremities so that putting on shoes or clothing proved very difficult, as did breathing. You called me from a local store crying that you could not find pants to fit you. We talked long distance, and I calmed you down, as always, not allowing you to wallow in self-pity and trying to help. You went home and found a new pair of stretch pants Alice and I had bought you, and you were happy. You had 2 changes of clothes that fit to take to the hospital. No sweat. All was well. The procedure was not dangerous, and you'd undergone it several times in recent years. It would require a day or two in the hospital and not see you again in the weekend. I could not be with you on Monday, February 22nd, when you had to go into the hospital, as I nearly always had, because of work. You were supposed to be admitted the previous Friday when I was off, but the date was changed and I could not be with you next Friday. You were unconcerned. This was routine. You'd be fine. I'd see you soon. We'd go see Mom on Friday when you'd be much lighter and feel much better. Perhaps we'd go shopping for clothes if the procedure still left you too bloated for your regular clothing size, You were transported by ambulance. I was concerned, but not too worried. You called me sometime between 5 or 6 p.m. to tell me you were fine and resting at the hospital. Don't worry. I'm safe here and well cared for. We talked for a little while about the usual things, with my assuring you I'd see you Friday or Saturday. You were tired and wanted to sleep, and I asked you to call me if you woke up later that night, else we would speak tomorrow. I got a call from your cell phone at 10 p.m., and I answered in my usual upbeat manner. Hey, puppy. On the other side was a nurse, telling me my dad had fallen. I assured her she was mistaken, as my dad was there for a procedure to drain abdominal fluid, not because of a fall. You don't understand. He fell from his bed and struck his head on the nightstand or something, and his heart has stopped. We're working on him for 20 minutes, and it does not look good. Can you get here? I could not. I had had 2 or 3 glasses of wine shortly before the call with dinner. I could not drive the 3 hours to Middletown. I cried. I prayed. 15 minutes later, I got the call that you were gone. Lost in grief, I called my wife. Shortly thereafter came a call from the coroner's office. An autopsy was required. I could not see you until they were done. 4 days later, your body was finally released to the funeral director I had selected for his experience with the process of interment in Spain. I saw you for the last time to identify your body. I kissed my fingers and touched your mangled brow. I'd not even have the comfort of an open casket. You wanted cremation. Your body awaits it as I write this. You were alone, even in death alone. In the hospital, as strangers worked on you. In the coroner's office, as you awaited the autopsy. In the autopsy table, as they poked and prodded, further rending your flesh, looking for clues that would change nothing and benefit no one, least of all you. I could not be with you for days, and then only for a painful moment. We will have a memorial service next Friday with your ashes and a mass on Saturday. I will never again see you in this life. Alice and I will take you home per your wishes to the cemetery in Oleiros, La Coruña, Spain, this summer to await the love of your life, who could not understand my tears or your passing, and will join you there in the fullness of time. There is one blessing to dementia. Mom asks for her mom and is worried because she has not come to visit in some time. She is coming, she assures me, whenever I see her. You visited her every day, except when health absolutely prevented it. You spent this February 10th apart, your 61st wedding anniversary, too sick to visit her. Nor was I there. First time. I hope you did not realize you were apart on the 10th, but doubt it to be the case. I did not mention it, hoping you'd forgotten, and neither did you. You were my link to Mom. She cannot dial or answer the phone, so you would put your cell phone to her ear whenever I was not in class or a meeting and could speak to her. She always recognized me by phone. I am 3 hours from her. I could visit at most once or twice a month. Now, even that daily phone line is severed. Mom is completely alone, afraid, confused, and I cannot, in the short term, do much about that. You were not supposed to die first. It was my greatest fear and yours. But as with so many things we cannot change, I put it in the back of my mind. It kept me up many nights, but like you, I still believed and believe in miracles. I'd spent every night with you, often for an hour, on the way home from work late at night during my hour-long commute, or from home on days when I worked from home as I cooked dinner. I mostly let you talk, trying to give you what comfort and social outlet I could. You were lonely, sad, stuck in an endless loop of emotional and physical pain. Lately, you were especially reticent to get off the phone. When Mom was still home and still relatively well, I'd call every day too, but usually spoke to you for only a few minutes before you transferred the phone to Mom, with whom I usually chatted much longer. For months, you'd had difficulty hanging up. I knew you did not want to go back to the couch, to a mindless television program, or to paying more bills. You'd say goodbye, or enough for today, and immediately begin a new thread, sometimes repeating the cycle 5 or 6 times. You even told me crying recently, "Just hang up on me, or I'll just keep talking." I loved you, Dad, with all my heart. We argued, and I'd often scream at you in frustration, knowing you would not take it to heart, and would usually just ignore me and do exactly as you pleased. I knew how desperately you needed me, and I tried to be as patient as I could. But there were days when I was too tired, too frustrated, too full of other problems. There were days when I got frustrated with you, and just staying on the phone for an hour when I needed to call my wife to eat my cold dinner, or even to watch a favorite TV program. I felt guilty. I almost never cut a conversation short, but I was frustrated nonetheless, even knowing how much you needed me, how much I needed you, and how little you asked of me. How I would love to hear your voice again, even if you wanted to complain about the same old things or tell me in minutest detail some unimportant aspect of your day. I thought I'd have a little longer, a year, two. God only knew, and I could hope there would be time. I had so much more to share with you, to learn from you, when life eased up just a bit. You taught me to fish, it didn't take, and to hunt, that took even less, and much of what I know about mechanics and electronics. We worked on our cars together for years, brake jobs, mufflers, wheel tune-ups in the days when points, condensers, and timing lights had meaning, rebuilding carburetors, fixing rust and dent, power windows, and more. We were friends, good friends, who went on Sunday drives to favorite restaurants or shopping for tools when I was single and lived at home. You taught me everything in life about all the things that matter. The rest is meaningless paper and window dressing. I knew your few faults and your many colossal strengths. And I knew you to be the better man. Not even close. I could never do what you did. I could never excel in my fields as you did in yours. You were the real deal in every way, from every angle, throughout our life. I did not always treat you that way, but I loved you very deeply, as anyone who knows us knows. More importantly, you knew it. I told you often, unembarrassed in the telling. I love you, Dad. The world was enriched by your journey. You do not leave behind wealth or a body of work to outlive you. You never had your 15 minutes of fame. You mattered. God knows. Your virtue, your absolute integrity, and the purity of your heart. I will never know a better man, and will carry you in my heart every day of my life. God bless you, Dad. Unsung Heroes number 6, Lita, 1929 to 2018. Mom, you were born 5 years before the beginning of the Spanish Civil War and lived in a modest two-story home in the lower street of Fontan, facing the ocean that gifted you its wealth and bounty and robbed you of your beloved and noblest eldest brother, Juan, who was killed while working as a fisherman out to sea at the tender age of 19. You were a little girl much prone to crying. The neighbors would make you cry just by saying, "Chora, niña, chora," cry, little girl, cry, which instantly produced inconsolable wailings. At the age of 7 or 8, you were blinded by an eye infection. The village doctor eventually saved your eyesight, but not before you missed a full year of school. You never recovered that lost time. Your impatience as being left behind prevented you from making up for lost time. Your wounded pride, the shame of not knowing what your friends knew, your restlessness and inability to hold your tongue when corrected by your teacher created a perfect storm that tossed your diminutive boat toward the rocks. When still little, you saw Franco with his escort leave his yacht in Fontan. With the innocence of a girl who never learned to hold her tongue, you asked a neighbor who was also present, "Who is that man?" "The Generalissimo Francisco Franco," she answered and whispered, "Se viva Franco," when he passes by. You pointed and screamed out, "That's the Generalissimo?" followed by peals of laughter. "He looks like Tom Thumb." A member of his protective detail raised his machine gun to strike you with its stock. "Leave her alone," Franco ordered. "She's just a child. The fault is not hers." You told that story many times in my presence, always with a smile or laughing out loud. I don't believe you ever appreciated the possible import of your feat of contempt for authority. Could that act of derision have played some small part in their much later coming for your father and taking him prisoner, torturing him for months, and eventually condemning him to be executed by firing squad in the Plaza de Maria Pita as a traitor? He escaped his fate with the help of a fascist officer who freed him. Such was his reputation, the power of his ideas, and the esteem of friends who did not share his political views. Such was your innocence or psychic blind spot that you never realized your possible contribution to his destruction. You could not have borne it if you had. You adored your dad throughout your life with a passion of which he was most deserving. He died shortly after the end of the Civil War. A mother with 10 mouths to feed needed help. You stepped up in response to her silent, urgent need. At the age of 11, you left school for good and managed to get a full-time job in a cousin's cannery. Children could not legally work in Franco, Spain. Nevertheless, a cousin who owned a cannery took pity on your situation and allowed you to work full-time in his factory in Sava. You earned the same salary as the adults. You earned the same salary as the predominantly women adult workers and worked better than most of them with a dexterity and rapidity that served you well your entire life. In your free time before work, you carried water from the communal fountain to neighbors for a few cents. You also made trips carrying a large sedia on your head for home and a pail in each hand. You rose long before sunrise to get the water for home and for the local fishermen before they left on their daily fishing trips to fill their personal water pails. All of the money you earned went to your mom with great pride that a girl could provide more than the salary of a grown woman at the mere cost of her childhood and schooling. You also washed clothes for neighbors for a few cents more. Diapers for newborns you always washed for free for the pleasure of being allowed to hold the babies you so dearly loved. When you were old enough to go to the Sunday cinema and dances, you continued the same routine and added washing and ironing the Sunday clothes of young fishermen who wanted to look their best for the weekly dances. The money from that third job was your own to pay for weekly hairdos, the cinema, and dance hall entry fees. At 16, you wanted to emigrate to Buenos Aires to live with an aunt and uncle. Your mom agreed, provided that you took your younger sister and mother's namesake, Remedios, with you. You later found you could not legally work in Buenos Aires either as a minor. So you lied about your age and got a job as a nurse's aide at a clinic soon after your arrival. You washed bedpans, made beds, scrubbed floors, and all the other similarly aligned tasks to earn enough money to pay for the passage of your mom and your two youngest brothers, Cito, Jose, and Paco, Francisco. Later, you got a job as a maid at a hotel in the resort town of Mar del Plata, whose owners loved your passion for children and put their infants in your care. You served as a maid and an unpaid nanny. Between your modest salary and tips as a maid, you soon made the rest of the money that you needed for your mom's and brother's passage from Galicia. You returned to Buenos Aires and found two rooms you could afford in an excellent neighborhood in the city center at an old boarding house near the Spanish consulate. Afterwards, you got a job at the Pond's laboratory as a machine operator, packaging Pond's beauty products. You made good money and helped to support your mom and brothers while she continued working as hard as she always had in Spain, no longer selling fish, but cleaning a funeral home and washing clothing by hand for well-to-do clients. When your brothers were old enough to work, they joined you in supporting your mom and getting her to retire from working outside the home. You lived with your mom in the same boarding house until you married Dad years later, and you never lost the bad habit of stubbornly speaking your mind no matter the cost. Your union tried to force you to register as a peronista. Once burned, twice cautious, you refused, telling the syndicate you had not escaped one dictator to align yourself with another. They threatened to fire you. When you still would not yield, they threatened to repatriate you, your mom, and your brothers back to Spain if you did not join the party. I can't print your reply here. They finally brought you before the Pond's general manager, demanding he fire you. You demanded a valid reason for their request. The manager, doubtless at his own peril, refused, saying he had no better worker than you and the union had no cause to demand your dismissal. After several years of courtship, you and Dad married. You both had the world well in hand with well-paying jobs and strong savings that would have allowed you to live very comfortably. You seemed incapable of having children that you longed for. So 3 years of painful treatments finally allowed you to give me life, and we lived 3 more years in a lovely apartment. I have memories from a very tender age, and I remember that apartment very well. But things changed when you and Dad started businesses that soon became unsustainable in the hyperinflation and economic chaos of Argentina of the early 1960s. I remember only too well your and Dad's extreme sacrifice during that time, a theme for another day. You were the hardest working person I've ever known. You were not afraid of any honest job, no matter how challenging, and your restlessness and competitive spirit always made you a stellar employee everywhere you worked. Even at home, you could not stand still unless there was someone with whom to chat a while over coffee or a meal. You are a truly great cook, thanks in part to learning from the chef of the hotel where you worked in Mar del Plata, a fellow Spaniard of Basque descent who taught you many of his signature dishes of Spanish and Italian specialties. You are always terribly picky eater, but you loved to cook for family and friends, the more the merrier, and for the holidays. Dad was also a terrific cook, but with a more limited repertoire. I learned to cook with great joy from both of you at a young age. And though neither my culinary skills nor any aspect of my life can match yours or Dad's, I too am a decent cook. And like you, I love to cook, especially meals to be shared with friends and family. You took great pleasure in introducing my friends to some of your favorite dishes, such as cazuela de mariscos, paella marinera, caldo gallego, stews, roasts, and your incomparable canelones, gnocchis, orejas, crepes, muñuelos, flan, and the rest of your long culinary repertoire. In primary and middle school, Dad picked me up every day for lunch. You both worked the second shift and did not leave for work until around 2 p.m. On many days, Dad would bring a cartload of classmates with me for lunch. I well remember the faces of my Jewish, Chinese, Japanese, German, Irish, Italian, and African-American friends when first introduced to octopus, caldo gallego, cazuela de mariscos, and flan. The same was true during college and law school. At times, our home resembled a UN General Assembly meeting, but always featuring food. You always treated my closest friends as if they were your children, and a number of them, to this day, see you as a second mother, though most have not seen you for many years. You had tremendous passion and affinity for being a mother, a great pity to have had just one child. It made you overprotective. You bought my clothes at an expensive boutique. I became a living doll for someone denied such toys as a girl. You would not let me out of your sight and kept me in germ-free environments that produce negative health issues. My pediatrician told you often, "I want to see him with dirty fingernails and scraped knees." You dismissed the statement as a joke. You take me often to the park and to my favorite merry-go-round, but I had no friends until I was 7 or 8 years old, and then just one. I did not have a real full circle of friends until I was around 13 years old. Sad. I was walking and talking up a storm in complete sentences when I was 1 year old, according to you and Dad. You were concerned, and you took me to my pediatrician, who laughed. He showed me his keychain and asked, "Dan, what are these, Danny?" "Those are your car keys," I replied to his surprise. After an evaluation, he told you to always encourage and feed my curiosity. According to you, I was unbearable. Some things never change. I asked Dad endless questions, such as, "Why can't I see a reflection of a flashlight pointed at the sky at night? What makes the sun hot, and how far away is it? Why don't airplanes have pontoons on top of their wheels so they can land on water and land, etc., 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 ad nauseum, ad infinitum?" He would answer me patiently to the best of his ability and wait for the inevitable follow-up question. I remember train and bus rides sitting on his lap asking him 1,000 questions. When I asked you a question you could not answer, unfortunately, you often made up an answer rather than saying, "I don't know," or "Go ask Dad," or "Go to hell, you little monster." It drove you crazy. Whatever you were doing, I wanted to learn to do. Working on a sewing machine, knitting, cooking, ironing, anything that looked even remotely interesting. I can't imagine your frustration. Yet you always found only joy in your little boy at all ages. Such was your enormous love which surrounded me every day of my life and still does. When you told me a story I did not like the ending of, such as with Little Red Riding Hood, I demanded a better one, and I would cry interminably if I didn't get it. Poor mom. What patience. Reading or making up a story that little Danny did not approve of could be dangerous. I remember one day in a movie theater watching the cartoons I loved. Donald Duck came out from stage right eating a sandwich. Sitting between you and Dad, I asked you for a sandwich. Rather than explaining that the sandwich was not real, that would go eat my favorite steak sandwich as usual later, you simply told me that Donald Duck would bring me the sandwich soon. Well, the scene changed and Donald had eaten a sandwich. But then all hell broke loose. I wailed at the top of my lungs that Donald Duck had eaten my sandwich. He had lied to me. That was unbearable. There was no way to console me or to make me understand too late that Donald Duck was also hungry, that it was his sandwich, not mine, or that what was on the screen was just a cartoon and not real. He, Donald Duck, my favorite Disney character then and now, had lied to me. Such a betrayal was intolerable. You and Dad had to drag me out of the theater, ranting at the injustice at the top of my lungs. The tantrum, extremely rare for me then, less so now, was epic. But all was well again when my beloved Tia Nieves gave me a cracker with jam from Donald. So much water under the bridge. Your own memories, like smoke in a soft breeze, have dissipated into its insubstantial molecules, like stars in this night sky that paint no coherent picture. An entire life of vital conversations turned to the whispers of children in a hurricane. Insubstantial fragments, just a dream that interrupts an eternal nightmare. That is your life today. Your memory was always prodigious. You knew the name of every person you ever met and could recall long conversations verbatim. 3 years of schooling proved more than sufficient for you to go out into the world, carving your own path through the inhospitable wilderness, learning to read and write at the age of 16. You would have been a far better lawyer than I, a fiery litigator who would have fought injustice wherever you found it, and would always fight for those who could not defend themselves, especially children, who were always your most fervent passion. You sacrificed everything for others, always putting yourself dead last, and never asked for anything in return. You were an excellent dancer and could sing like an angel. Song was your release in times of joy and pain. You did not drink or smoke or overindulge in anything. For much of your life, your only minor indulgence was a weekly trip to the beauty parlor, even in Spain, when your washing and ironing income paid for that. It was not vanity, just self-respect. You loved people, and unlike Dad, who was for the most part shy, you were quite happy in the role of the life of the party, singing, dressing up as Charlie Chaplin or a newborn for New Year's Eve parties with family and close friends. You were a natural storyteller and entertained anyone who would listen with anecdotes, stories, jokes, and lively conversation. In short, you were an exceptional person with a large spirit, a mischievous streak, and an enormous heart. I know I am not objective about you, but any of your surviving friends and family members who knew you well will attest to this. You had an incredibly positive, indomitable attitude that sometimes led you to rush in where angels fear to tread. Life handed you cartloads of lemons, enough to drown and pickle the most ardent optimist, and you made not just lemonade, but lemon meringue pie, lemon sorbet, lemon drops, and then ground the rind to add to flan and a dozen other delicacies. And when all the lemons were gone, he sowed the seeds to grow beautiful lemon trees with fruit sweeter than cherries or plums. I've always said with great pride that you are a far better writer than I. How many excellent novels, plays, and poems would you have written with half of my education and three times my workload? There is no justice in this world. Your prodigious memory no longer allows you to recognize even me. I was the last person you forgot. But even now, when you can no longer speak in any language, sometimes your eyes sparkle and you call me Neninho, my little boy in Galician, and I know for an instant that you are no longer alone. But too soon the light fades and the darkness returns, and I can only see you a few hours a week. These visits are bittersweet, but I am ever so grateful for them. Someday I won't even have the opportunity to spend a few hours with you. You'll have no monument to mark your passing, save in my memory, so long as reason remains. An entire life of incalculable sacrifice will leave behind only the poorest living legacy of love. In this, your son, who lacks appropriate words to adequately honor your memory, and always will. The day has come too soon, October 11th, 2018. The call came in at 3:30 in the morning, an hour or two after I had fallen asleep. They tried CPR in vain. There will be no more opportunities to say I love you, to caress your hands and face, to softly sing in your ear, to put cream on your hands, or hope that this week you might remember me. No more time to tell you the accomplishments of loved ones, who I saw, what they told me, who asked about you this week, or to pray over you, or ask you if you would give me a kiss by putting my cheek close to your lips, to feel joy when you graced me with many tiny little kisses in response, or to tell you, well, maybe next week, when more often than not, you did not respond. In saying goodbye, I'd give you the kiss and hug Alice always sent you, followed by three more kisses on the forehead from Dad. He always gave you three. And one from me. I'd leave the TV on to a channel with people and no sound. When possible, I would wait for you to close your eyes before leaving so you would not see me go. Time has run out. No further extensions are possible. My prayers change from asking God to protect you and by His grace allow you to heal just a little bit each day, to praying that God protect your soul and Dad's, and that He allow you both to rest in peace in His kingdom. I miss you and Dad very much and will do so as long as God grants me the gift of reason. 4 years seeing your blinding light reduced to a weak, flickering candle in total darkness. 4 years fearing that you might be aware of your situation. 4 years praying that you would not feel pain, sadness, or loneliness. 4 years learning to say goodbye. The rest of my life now, waiting in the hope of seeing you again. I love you, Mom and Dad, with all my heart, always and forever. Thank you for listening, folks. God bless you.